Thank you, Dick. I'm actually standing in for Joy. These are colleagues of mine. I work with climate in mitigation in WHO, and we're covering policies in different sectors, how they do mitigate. My colleagues, including Joy Guillermo, who's the responsible for this presentation, have been working in adaptation. And what they've been doing is trying to create a system to help developing countries mostly to assess vulnerability and therefore plan their own adaptation strategies as well as apply for or be better equipped to apply to adaptation funds, which exist in the context of the IPCC. So what I'll cover is the need for this to assess and to evaluate better the vulnerability of populations, the role of assessments in climate change policy, what they are doing in terms of guidance for countries that WHO has been pulling together, and it's quite possible that some people here would be have been involved on that. I have a list of the working group who contributed to that at the end, and some of the early lessons. We're seeing that there's a very big vulnerability, and you've covered that, but you know, globally, we think this is extremely important. Especially because some people are very vulnerable for a variety of reasons, and many countries are. And you have just the numbers of the kinds of diseases like undernutrition, diarrhea, malaria, that is already causing a lot of mortality and disease, and which is expected to increase. Globally, there's also this issue of inequality, which is central to the climate change negotiations. I don't know if you've been to any one of those, but they are really a fight between who was to blame for this and who should pay for it, for that. So it's quite exciting environment to be, and I generally recommend. I mean, there's few things which are as you know heartfelt as these debates, and but basically the top. I'm sure you know this. The top of the graph is who historically contributed to climate change gases. At the bottom is who's suffering this today. Although health is thoroughly covered in the Rio Declaration of 92 in the UNFCCC, UN Convention for Climate Framework Convention for Climate Change, and it's supposed to be included everywhere, the reality is that it isn't. And I'm looking for another slide, this one, because we see that of the damage costs which are estimated from climate change, in relation to that, the equivalent which is being put from money from the climate fund, from a climate adaptation fund, is only 0.5%. So although the costs are very high, and they are recognized to be very high, the kinds of monies which are going into that are minimal. It's not that countries are not identifying that as a problem, because if you want in the assessments that the NAPAs, the National Adaptation Plans, they all have health very high, and it's 98% or 95%, which consider that health is the reason for doing a NAPA. But what happens is that when you go to the implementation, most of them, even the plans, are not appropriate. It's the justification includes health, but the plans already are pretty poor. And when it comes to money, it's very minimal. So we feel that this disconnect, one, is very crucial. And a plan or an assessment could help countries to be better prepared to apply for funds and to implement adaptation policies which are more effective. So this vulnerability assessment has been planned as a method that was created initially in Europe by our regional office. It has been later being included more of the Americas, and there's a current version which is supposed to have, it's an improved version. And while you were making the presentations, I was thinking that there was a lot of cross-fertilization that could still be done. I feel that there's some of the issues that you are raising are very important. However, I would raise that if you have 75 indicators, then that's difficult to follow up on all of them, and some of them are pretty broad. So the devil is in the detail. I mean, you have to, at one point in the evaluation, identify which are the issues that you can have a handle on, and how much benefit you get out of your investment in X or Y policy. So I think that those two sides of the equation, you have to have an inclusive view, no doubt, but monies are limited, and especially for developing countries, emerging economies. So you have to see, one, what are the specific issues, and two, where are the economic opportunities for implementing those? And that's quite crucial. And I think the whole debate around green economy, the role of new investments on new energy efficiency, and there's globally, there's a very big push on that, and this is going to be central for Rio Plus 20. So I think those opportunities have to be harnessed in the context of, and I'll make that comment as, I was not supposed to speak while I was a city. So this evaluation, so it's to raise awareness about the linkages between health and adaptation, and the awareness is not there. I think that's very clear in the minds of climate people. This is still not, it's evident as a problem, you know, as a reason for taking action, but not what actions would be better for health. That's not yet into that equation. One, to understand locally what are the causal issues and the context. Build evidence on the nature and magnitude and distribution of the risks in the localities. Identify gaps and help prioritize problems and actions. And I go back to the broad picture and the specific actions which are feasible and most relevant in any specific circumstance. So this is what was done. There was one first document developed in Europe, which was then discussed at a workshop and adapted on the basis of further experience, and they're publishing this document, which what you see on the right of the slide. There's also a number of resource links which are on the web and are listed there. In a nutshell, what is happening there is it's a process and is designed to meet policy programs and decisions, needs in those countries. It's relatively flexible to respond to the circumstances, both financial and human, at the local level, and uses a range of tools depending which are adapted to the context. And it involves assessing vulnerability of people and of health systems, envisioning what are the kinds of impacts that are expected on health, and how many minutes I have? And to assess the adaptation options. So this is what it looks like. It provides a frame, it provides an assessment, and it provides a risk management tool. And that's quite important as well, because often in health impact assessments, as we know well, we end up focusing a lot on the assessments, relatively little in the management processes in the follow-up and the documenting the outcomes. So this is a concern for us working climate change in WHO, and we feel that the ability to report on what actually happened following a specific set of options and policy decisions and investments, where your money went, what happened, is actually crucial for us in public health to be able to demonstrate what is the performance of those investments and take to task, you know, some of the identify which decisions were wise and which not, and exchange experience, because most countries are in the same situation that we're all doing evaluations to in that direction. This is just one example in Barbados, where the specific issue was to do with dengue, and because Barbados needed to do a lot of rainwater harvesting, they had to sort of take precautions which were directed at that issue. And I suppose if you take your area in California, the question that I was asking, that you seem to assume, and I'll put my other question, that air conditioning is a way to protect people from extreme weather. On the other hand, my question was, is there any natural ventilation things being considered? Because you could go out of power, you're creating more climate change gases. I mean, what are the other alternatives, and how resilient your alternative or your proposal to protect from climate change is in virtue of the kinds of events which are going to happen because of climate change? So I think we have to also look at those opportunities. Some of the early lessons, and I think this is the last slide, and should be framed as a process, and this was thought was to be important. I should say that a lot of countries in Africa, all countries in Africa, are conducting this vulnerability assessments and trying to get together around the climate fund in Durban to sort of push for health to be included using this as a basis. This is not about assessing sensitivity of single diseases or trends to climate variables, but is also about engaging with stakeholders. I think your local national experience speaks to that. And it has to identify the local health determinants. And then carrying out exercises and working with people in the field is also quite crucial. I would say that in our work, from my side, that I work more on mitigation, what's recently emerging, and it emerged in our work in mitigation, is a lot of mitigation is also adaptation. And some of adaptation is also mitigation. So we shouldn't be splitting that up so purposefully, because it doesn't add.
It's not useful.
Yeah, and in fact, in global context, it's very counterproductive, because people in developing countries feel mitigation is what the North should do, they should pay for it, it's none of our business, and we only focus on adaptation. And in fact, if you look at the benefits of both about adaptation and mitigation, they are local. They are measured in health terms. So they have a lot to gain. And I think we as a public health community have a contribution to make that very important political debate and standstill. I think that there's a very real issue there in terms of bridging the gap and showing that the benefits can occur at the local level. Now, being specific and being clear about what the policies that do improve, that adapt, and is quite crucial. And we have to be able to quantify, to be able to elect which are the best ones. So I'll leave it to that, and I think I've encouraged, I don't know how much exchange you've had with the WHO group, but I think you have a fantastic experience, and I'm sure that this could be illuminating for people there. Thank you. These are the people who carry out that work.
Could I ask the speakers to come on up to the front for a minute? I'm going to put you on the spot. If you had to tell us, you may need to. Don't forget, there's a special environmental justice session tomorrow night from 6:30 to 8. At, it doesn't say where it is, but there is one tomorrow night.
It's in the convention center.
204A. Thank you. So here's my question. You're called into a high elected official's office, and we go through this whole discussion, and she says, look, all this is so far away. I'm running for re-election in 18 months. Tell me what the one thing I need to do to meet and confront the issues that you've raised, whether it's issues of science and data and research, issues of how we scale and measure, how we deal with the international, how we deal with justice. And this is a hard question, but I am putting you a little on the spot. While you're thinking, I'm going to tell a quick story. people that know me know this is true. So we used to have the Refugee and International Health Group at CDC in my center, and I learned a lot about sending people into very, very difficult, austere, frightening circumstances at times. And things feel very chaotic. What do you think the first thing they have to do is? And, of course, there is, well, water and immunizations and food. What do you think the first thing the CDC people do?
Communication.
Okay, good. So you have to have some kind of communication system. And with that communication, what's the next thing you begin to do? The big thing is collecting. That's right, you have to listen. You have to collect the data. You got to know how many people are dying, where they're dying, what they're sick of, where they're getting sources. It's really data collection, and it's not desperately interesting or as dramatic as setting up a field hospital and rehydrating dehydrated people. But if you spend huge amounts of money on a field hospital that you don't need and you're ignoring something else in that community, you got to have the intelligence in the front of the system. So I'm actually leading into the question about what would be some of the first research needs that one would want to think about, Rachel, as the governor wants to know what he can do in the next 18 months that really is going to help him look good and really be a contribution to all of this. And you're welcome to use this if you'd like.
Well, I guess I would say that we have a lot of data, and there's been a lot of people that have done excellent work now, and that, yes, science always needs to get better, and we need to have better measures and so on and so forth, but there's been a lot of work done now to give us an indication about where we really need to be targeting our climate adaptation strategies and efforts. And I think the biggest challenge, particularly in the state of California, where we're dying from, you know, our budget woes, basically, is, but we do have a pretty amazing climate change law that is expected to generate some revenue through cap and trade. So there has been some discussion about a proportion of those revenues being set aside to address what people call a community benefits fund, essentially, to very much address these kinds of issues. So Governor Jerry Brown, in this case, could send very good signals to the legislature that he would be prepared to sign something like this if the legislature reintroduced something like this in the bill, and that could actually start funneling money to start addressing some of these planning approaches and actually use the day that we have to do something.
Now, I could imagine, and Dr. Wilson, you might want to respond to this, I could imagine in California politics that suddenly there'd be a huge amount of pressure to have that money go to Beverly Hills and Brentwood and Marin County, and the folks that in some of the Hawthorne and places that don't have the parks, don't have the green space, don't have the even schools and other kinds of resilient infrastructure, will be at the back of the line asking for the share of that revenue. Any quick thoughts on this?
Oh, that's a good point. I mean, I think Rachel would be there to actually advocate to make sure the resources are actually targeted to those communities that, I mean, you think about from an EJ perspective, and you actually can apply this to the stimulus funds. In the same way, many of those stimulus funding, which is went to cities, did not go to the places that most needed the resources. So in a way, that funding may actually lead to more sprawl, lead to sort of more disparities in the built environment. So that's been one critique that we've sort of had, and many in the EJ community have had, on the application of the stimulus funds. In the same way, if that funding does not have at its core the principles of equity, fairness, and justice, the focus on those most vulnerable, then the funding could potentially go to, like you said, communities that don't necessarily need it immediately. You know, the communities that really need it are communities, for example, in Maryland, that have underlying health disparities, as I said before, that have built environment disparities, as I said before, that are in poor housing stock, where they don't have this whole issue of mechanical ventilation. You know, mechanical ventilation is very important for many communities. It'd be great to have access to have natural ventilation, but in many places, that natural ventilation is not going to really be, unless you have good architectural modifications. But even with that, if you look at the housing stock issue, people are not even at a good baseline yet as it relates to good housing stock.
Okay, well, let me push back. I think California got $66 million in Safe Routes to Schools money. And the counties that pulled together the most effective and punchy requests for that money were the counties that actually had good infrastructure, had grants writers, had people that really knew how to do this. And the counties where people are just scrambling to get by and cope, Fresno, for example, could not get to the front of the line. They couldn't articulate one or two things. Politicians love to have somebody come in and tell them 10 things to do because that means they don't have to do anything. You have to come in with a very simple one or two asks to go forward. So how do we make sure that the counties who have been really disenfranchised, counties, localities, whatever way you want to put it, the ones who have been disenfranchised can really get what they need?
I mean, part of what we do, if you think about community-based participatory research, to really focus on capacity building. And so to get the counties who really need it, part of it is actually building capacity so they can be competitive. That's one way. getting back to Rachel said, the targeting is another way. If you just do simple demographic statistical analysis, you can see where you need to go. I think Rachel's tool actually provides you with the places where we should target. So if you have it in the law that based on these analysis, we first go here, that in a, if it's embedded in the law, will actually help to address that problem. But the law doesn't have that equity component with it, then we'll have some of the same issues that you just talked about.
Go ahead. Out loud.
Go ahead.
Let's make sure they vote. Let's make sure
people have to turn out.
Voting.
That's right.
And we heard this morning that the demographics are shifting in this country, and if we can convince the politicians that they have to listen to these EJ communities because they're going to be a big voting pool, I think maybe that's one strategy.
Yeah, voting is part of it, but part of the problem is when we talk about voting, that's only one small part of civic engagement. So we really need to get people not just to vote, but to be civically engaged after they go place the vote. And a lot of folks don't, they're not civically engaged. I don't think really true civic engagement is actually voting. I think it's really beyond voting and doing collaborative problem solving and being participatory as it relates to addressing those local issues.
This is what I want this dialogue with the group. Nice and loud.
Thank you. However, just as you said, in order to really create a fundable proposal, you need to have the internal technical capacity to write a plan. And so we had this long conversation with them that, in a sense, you may be perpetuating health disparities because the incentive structure for the grants is driving that gap wider. And I'm wondering how many other states might have.
Just a safe routes to schools in California, actually one of the early things they did was actually put a grants writer and a skilled person with this in the communities that needed it most. When you talk about this, it sounds desperately boring. Oh, he put a couple grant writers in really poor communities, but it's really critical as this goes forward. Rachel?
No, I was just going to say, I think often this is a common pitfall where the first-come, first-served system seems on its face to be neutral when in fact it ends up actually being in effect discriminatory because those who are best equipped to get first in line are the ones that get the money. California had another experience of that when we passed a proposition to basically retrofit schools for earthquakes to rebuild and retrofit. And of course the districts that were predominantly in suburban areas that had an easy time identifying new sites for schools were the first in line. And that actually resulted in some interesting litigation, which didn't actually have to go to court and resulted in the settlement that certain portion of that pot would be set aside so that urban districts were not disproportionately impacted by an effectually discriminatory first-come, first-served system for those funds. The other thing I wanted to say is I think that when we're thinking about funding for climate adaptation, that money's going to have to be spread around. I mean, the most successful programs politically have always been the ones that have been available to everybody. It doesn't necessarily mean that everyone gets the same, but the real reason why the Medicare system is so successful in this country is that it's available to everybody. That's why it's sacred so far hasn't been dismantled. So I think we need to think in the same sort of political terms when we're trying to get funding to address inequities, but still making it available to everyone so that it's politically viable.
You got one big wish? Daniel?
I don't know if I'd say it's one big wish, but one thought that's coming to mind is that you can point to partnerships with business that could really be successful. And I think that you could work with businesses that are impacted in similar ways as the citizens in their community and have them, I think it would be a way to leverage and as a politician to succeed.
At this all-day training we did with Ed Maybeck on and others at Walls on Saturday, the use of language and the framing turns out to be, I never quite appreciate just how important your precise use of words is. And so actually we've evolved from global warming to climate change, and I'm beginning to think I should only talk about carbon pollution and shouldn't even talk about climate change because in a way that's much more, captures it in a much more substance. I'm not saying that's the solution, but
how you frame it, how you speak it is hugely important, and it goes there as well. Carlos, you want to take the last shot, and then we'll ask for some comments from the group?
I would say that you have to go with the issue which is already politically important. If I were in Rio, I would work with slums because there's violence, because there's concern of the whole population around that, and I would do a health impact assessment of I would offer the governor of Rio a health impact assessment of a slum improvement on housing and transport, and saying, well, you could invest this is what you could get. So at the same time, the politician could be selling the project as well as with a vision of what it would create in terms of health outcomes. And now we can do that because we have the tools for that. If I were in São Paulo, which is another Brazilian city where traffic congestion is much more of an issue, I would go with transport and sort of connect the. So I would go with something which is already pressing at the local level. But it complements very much what the others have been saying.
I mentioned this morning, but I'm going to really tap on it one more time. About a month ago, the National Academy of Sciences put out a report on health impact assessment. You can download it for free, get the PDF. I was on that committee along with Carlos. I was at the beginning skeptical of health impact assessment. I was skeptical because I felt that environmental impact assessment had not lived up to its promise of either protecting the environment or protecting people very well. And you'd read a 3,000-4,000 page environmental impact assessment. It would have 2-3 pages on human health, and it was not really germane to anything that, you know, it doesn't violate air standards or water standards, but does it give everybody diabetes and bad lungs? And scarcely deals with that. The two big things, I learned multiple things on this committee. One is the problem with environmental impact assessment was we never really implemented it right, and it does call for health assessment, and it needs to be in there. Number two, that community engagement is intrinsic to health impact assessment, and you don't do community impact at the engagement at the end. You do it at the beginning so that people are involved in the decision. Nobody wants to hear a naysayer at the end of the process, but they'll actually value your input at the beginning of the process if it's given courteously and with goodwill. The third issue, and this is very different from classic risk assessment, is it will incorporate benefits and options analysis, and we'll actually have a feedback loop into it as you evaluate as it goes forward. Because classic risk assessment doesn't look at a series of options and say these are the risk benefits for each one of these options. It sort of just gives you a quantitative number. And the problem with numbers is they dilute us into thinking we have the most important information because they're tangible in a way that we understand, and we can be tricked by it. So how do we capture the qualitative? Another quick comment from the audience, and I have time for about one or two.
I have a question and a comment. Thanks to all of you for those great, great presentations. It's a pretty big question, but a basic one. Vulnerability, because as Dr. Jackson, you were saying, words are matter. Do you find in your work that the term vulnerability, that it works for people, that it works for people in communities, that it works for policymakers as a way to prioritize, like those decisions that they're trying to make, like, okay, we've got this pot of money. You're telling us that this community or this location is vulnerable. Do people understand that when we prioritize what happens first, that everyone benefits?
And this is an up-down answer.
Like, does it work? Is it working for us and you in our work?
Quick.
I would say that it works sometimes, but that I see a stronger benefit when you can couch it in a positive term.
Yeah, right. That's the question. Is it perceived sometimes as negative?
Yeah, it's like for me the term minority. I hate the term minority. Mm-hmm. So for a lot of communities, it's like, something's wrong with me?
Yeah.
So I don't think when you're doing community engagement, I don't think it's the best term to use.
We're doing a climate change course.
Resilience.
That was exactly what I was going to say.
And yet it makes sense to map, as we've seen in people's work, the factors that are about vulnerability or risks or exposures or susceptibilities. But we use that word vulnerability because it captures a lot of those terms in a lot of those experiences in one term. But I think that a positive experience, resilience, is much more to what people want to be engaging in dialogue.
Like the term salutogenic is more positive than the term
pathogenic or, you know, how we do our work. So we need to talk about the positives more.
That's Kim Knowlton in the back. So we've been scrambling to do a climate change course at UCLA. Had a bunch of students come in to give me advice on the course, and the first thing they said is, we refuse to go to a course where you tell us the whole world is screwed. We're so tired of hearing about all this negative. We want to talk about how we can manage this in our generation and in our lifetime. And we came right back to resilience, and that's what the course is on now. Let's thank all the presenters.